Tuesday, and that means we visit Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the New York Times, investigative reporter David Farenthold. Let's talk about this Supreme Court argument that was heard yesterday on basically the right of the government to... Now, we're not talking about the government ordering posts removed, correct? We're talking about the ability of government officials to call up Facebook and say, hey, you made a mistake, right?
Right. And this is a tool, sort of an informal tool to fight disinformation. We're going to call you and, hey, say, you know, we're not ordering you, as you said, but we're telling you, you know, there's a post that's going viral on your site that's incorrect about, you know, something important to the public good, you know, vaccines or something else, and then letting the providers decide they want to take it down. Obviously, people on the right who are trying to defend vaccine misinformation say that that's, you know, just because the government says it, that is force. You know, it's not just a suggestion if it comes from the government. That argument seemed to be to not get a good reception from the Supreme Court justices. They seemed inclined to let the government continue doing things like that.
Yeah, I hadn't been following this case closely, but I assume that the reason it got all the way to the Supreme Court was that there was some level of force involved. I mean, reporters, you get calls all the time, I'm sure, as do I, from public officials who hear something you said and say, wait a minute, you got that wrong. How about covering this side of the story, right?
And sometimes they're not very nice about it.
Well, too bad, you know. We don't have to obey them. You
know? Right, exactly. I always assumed that was something they were allowed to do.
Yeah. So what happens next year? I guess they make their decision, but do you see any way that they're going to tell government agencies, if somebody is trying to push a fraudulent COVID cure, you can't say anything about it?
Yeah, I don't anticipate them saying that. It's hard to draw a line. And also imagine the worst case scenario. Imagine someone's, you know, Russian, you know, bots are on the website claiming that, you know, California has just fallen off into the ocean and there's a nuclear bomb in Chicago or something that was truly like damaging to public order. You'd have to have the government have the ability to at least call and say, hey, would you take that down? I can't imagine they would take away that kind of wide discretion.
Yeah. Okay. Now, the other case, the TikTok case, is would be basically compulsory. Either sell yourself or you go dark. What is the status of that? I understand that a buyer has surfaced.
Right. I mean, and maybe we should have predicted this. The potential buyer for TikTok. Remember, Republicans in Congress with Democratic support, are trying to pass a law saying that TikTok, which is owned by a Chinese parent company, should it should be divested by the Chinese company and be owned in America so that we can be sure that they're not sending our data back to China. And that bill is a strong chance of passage did pass in the House. It's uncertain passage chances in the Senate. Trump himself, who had been sort of the spiritual godfather of this, has turned around and now says TikTok is fine after meeting with one of TikTok's very biggest investors. But if they did sell it, if TikTok did sell, either because they had to or because they see this coming, the people who are emerging as a potential buyer is Steve Mnuchin, the former Treasury Secretary of Trump. So somebody who worked for Trump would be the indirect beneficiary of a public policy movement that Trump started.
Yeah, that does sound a little bit fishy. Where do you come down on that?
That sounds like Russia, doesn't it? I mean, I guess, you know, Mnuchin is somebody who has bought and sold big companies before. So, you know, I guess, and I don't know of a rule you could write that would bar him, you know, people like him from being part of this process. But it does seem wrong that somebody who, you know, helped sort of set this in motion would be the beneficiary of it. I just don't think at this point that the ban is going to happen. Trump having turned around on it, and I think other people in the Senate and the White House may feel a little sort of leery of trying to crack down on individual companies with some kind of foreign ownership. I don't think that ban's actually going to happen. So I don't think the sale's going to happen, but we'll see.
So you mean the whole thing's just going to be dropped and TikTok?
I think TikTok will continue as it is. You know, they say they keep all their data in the U.S., but I think they will continue as it is. I also don't think Joe Biden, who's having trouble with young voters, relatively, I mean, he's still supported by a lot of young voters, but not as much as usual in the polls, is going to want to do something that's going to make a whole bunch of young people mad. And that would certainly be the case if you shut down TikTok.
Huh. I thought he said he was going to sign the bill.
Well, maybe it hasn't gotten to him yet. Maybe he will. But it seems that it's one of those things in the election year that on the margins, I don't think it's worth the risk for him.
Yeah. Okay, the other big story, and this is right up your alley as somebody who has covered Donald Trump very closely, is that after... placing calls to, I guess they said, 30 bonding companies. Nobody would take on the job of bonding Trump for his New York court case, his civil fraud lawsuit there. So what does this mean? What's the next step here?
Well, on Monday, if nothing else happens, it means the Attorney General of New York can start seizing his assets. He's appealing that judgment, the $450 million-plus judgment that came down against him in the civil fraud lawsuit. And while you're on appeal, you still have to put the money up, the money that you were going to lose if you lose the appeal. And you can put up a bond, you know, basically get somebody else to put the money up for you. But it seems like the bond companies want you to prove that you have the liquid assets to pay them back if you lose the case and then really have to pay. And Trump doesn't. We think he only has about $350 million in cash. He's already pledged about $100 million of it for a bond in another lawsuit that he lost, the defamation case against E. Jean Carroll. So now he's faced with a choice. He can have the attorney general start seizing his assets. He can sell an asset if he has something that he can sell that easily, or he can declare bankruptcy. None of these are very attractive options for him.
Well, I thought, now that he has control of the Republican Party, can't he just use that money?
He's using a ton of it, and that's why the Republican Party has so little money now. It's because he uses it to fight his legal fees. But they would have to vote to just give him $450 million. And even for a political party, that's a lot of money. It's a lot of money for anybody. Yes, it wouldn't be too much money for Putin or the Saudis or somebody else to pay Trump. But it seems like it would be a lot to just suck out of the RNC.
Actually, now that you mentioned that, would that would be legal. If some foreign government wanted to kick in the money, they could do that?
It would be illegal if he promised some official act in return. If he said, you know, give me
Well, he
money,
wouldn't
you
do
know.
That.
No, right. But if they just gave him the money, I don't think there's anything on its face of it that would be illegal.
Yeah. The other thing here, which is a big deal, I don't know how close you get to economic news, but this settlement with the National Association of Realtors to change the commission setup, is that likely to make it any easier, because that's the big issue here in Seattle, for first-time buyers to get into a house?
It will. I mean, I think this is one of the last cartels in American life. One of the most frustrating experiences of buying a house is realizing you have to pay 6% of your income, you know, to this person who's done almost nothing, who drove you around and gave you a donut and showed you the house. this commission now is 6%. People think it'll decline to what it is in other countries, which is like 1-3%. So, yeah, I mean, it's not going to undo all the cost of living increases in a place like Seattle, but it is going to make it easier for home buyers.
Good. They need all the help they can get. David Ferenthold, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Choke points.
Let's go.
Lane sweeping update edition. We got a lot of feedback on Chris's story on lane sweeping, and one specific situation kept coming up. Here's Chris.
And just a reminder of what lane sweeping is. It's basically not going into the proper lane when you make a turn. Under Washington law, you must turn into the closest lane. It's pretty simple. Lane sweeping, huge problem, dangerous. We went over that last week. It's basically you must turn into the lane closest to you, but if you kind of move into the second one right away, that's illegal and it's dangerous. But a lot of listeners reached out to me about a very specific situation. It's including something that our own Heather Bosch brought up to me as well when I told her this story last week. What happens when you're turning and the closest lane is restricted in some way? Like, for instance, what if it's a bus-only lane? And that's specifically what Heather asked me. It's like, okay, well, do I turn into the closest lane, which is a bus lane? Or do I have to sweep into that second lane by definition? What am I supposed to do here? And so this isn't covered in the state law, in the RCW, nor is it in the city of Seattle code. Now, local jurisdictions can make kind of changes and things about restricted lanes, like is happening here in Seattle. So I spoke with the Seattle Police and the Seattle Department of Transportation, and here is the consensus. Though a bus-only lane is a restricted lane, drivers can turn into it at an intersection and then merge over. That is totally fine because it is the closest lane. Now, some more detail from SDOT. It is illegal to block that bus lane, so drivers shouldn't turn into it if that bus lane, say, is blocked with a bunch of buses, because then you're basically, then you're just sitting there, right? You need to get out of that lane. You cannot use the bus lane to pass other cars stuck in traffic or travel in it for longer than it is necessary to safely make a turn. So, yes, you can turn into that lane and then merge on over if it is safe to do so.
Mm-hmm. And if you hear a really loud honk from a giant bus behind you, you've been in the lane too long.
Most likely, yes. And Seattle is kind of odd. Let me rephrase. That's a sweeping statement that Ursula would like to say, but odd in certain circles because sometimes the bus lane also then has kind of a lane also to its right where you can use to turn into businesses or parking lots. So it can get a little hairy. Just remember, just try to pull into the lane closest and then make a good decision from there on out. But yeah, it's kind of unique. But the bottom line is turn into that closest lane.
We're learning more about a confrontation between sheriff's deputies and a man in body armor in Pierce County, and it turned deadly. Cairo News Radio's James Lynch is tracking this case and spoke with our news director, Charlie Harger.
Let's take a deeper dive on a story we first brought you yesterday morning. An officer involved shooting. One man is dead. James Lynch, you went to the scene of what happened, and what did you learn?
Well, we're told that this happened just after 1 o'clock yesterday morning. That would be Monday morning. It was in an area on the east side of Tacoma, one that the sheriff department considers a bit of a troubled area. There is a lot of homelessness there, and there is some drug use. What they tell us is that they were on a routine patrol in that area doing some proactive work. They noticed a group of three men sitting out front of the smoke shop at 1 o'clock in the morning. So obviously they pull over to take a look and see what's going on. The first man that they talked to had a couple of arrest warrants, one for a felony, one for a misdemeanor. They immediately detained him and put him in cuffs. When they turned to the second guy, he took off running. They say clearly had a gun in his hand and ran down an area of railroad tracks where police say, or deputies say, they run down those tracks and jump a fence, and then they can get into an apartment complex and they can get lost over there. Something down the tracks happened. The next thing that happened after deputies chased him was that they called out on their radio that shots have been fired. We now know that two of deputies actually fired their weapon. We don't know yet if the suspect fired his weapon. We don't know how many times he was hit. What we do know is that he was fatally injured and died there at the scene.
And what we had heard yesterday morning, initial reports, he was wearing some sort of body armor.
Yeah, and that's something that's really concerning to deputies and to police everywhere. Not only do you have a suspect who is armed, who's outside of a closed business at 1 in the morning, but after he is shot and he's down, they're attempting CPR on it, and they find that he has a ballistic vest, a bulletproof vest on underneath his shirt. That is something that concerns all of law enforcement. And Sergeant Darren Moss Jr. with the Pierce County Sheriff Department, here's what he had to say about that kind of threat.
We like to think that we have an advantage because of training or body armor or other things. When we see somebody that's taking steps to arm themselves and wear body armor, it's concerning, especially if they're doing it against us.
And what Darren Moss Jr. said right there is that he believes that this guy was prepared for some type of trouble or some type of violence. He's carrying a gun. He's protecting himself with body armor. So they assume that he was probably up to no good.
Now, Pierce County Sheriff's Department, this is not the investigating agency, I would assume.
No, it is not. The Pierce County Force team will be investigating, and that is a number of officers, lieutenants from neighboring agencies there. The head is part of the Lakewood Police Department right now. They are conducting that investigation so that there is no public perception of impropriety, that the Sheriff's Department may try to skew information one way or the other. So they put a team in place to investigate the shooting that is not fully associated with the department or with the shooting.
And just so I have a clearer picture, James, you said it was a smoke shop. Is this a pot shop? Is this a cigarette store? What is this?
It was more of a smoke vape shop. You could go in there and pick up different things, glass to smoke marijuana out of and other accoutrement, if you will, that people use for drugs. And it also does have cigarettes and candy and other things in the store as well.
James Lynch, Cairo News Radio crime reporter. Thank you, James.
Thank you, sir.
Let's go to Texas now, where immigration has been the big topic for a long time. And yesterday, Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito further suspended Texas's new state immigration law. And we called up CBS correspondent Chris Fox, who covers everything happening in the Lone Star State. And I asked him what the consequences are as a result of this.
Governor Abbott took to social media shortly after, saying that SCOTUS temporarily halted enforcement of Senate Bill 4, but Texas is still using its authority to arrest illegal immigrants for criminal trespass and other violations of the law. We continue to build the wall, use National Guard to erect razor wire barriers to repel migrants, and buoys remain in the river. So basically, we wait until most likely what we're looking at is the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has a hearing scheduled in early April. So this law was first shot down, or first blocked, in federal court in Austin, Texas. Judge David Ezra blocked it from going into place, saying it most likely violated the Supremacy Clause, which basically states that immigration is a purview of the federal government, not states. The argument that the U.S. DOJ and the ACLU of Texas made was that you can't have 50 states with 50 different immigration systems, and this would be burdensome and hurt the overall system. So what we're looking at is basically seeing what the Fifth Circuit Court says about it. So that, like I said, that hearing is scheduled for, I believe, April 5th.
I was surprised to hear in the news feeds today local police chiefs being quoted as saying, hey, we're not ready for this. We don't have the jail space. We don't have the manpower. We haven't got the training. How would the law even be enforced if it were to take effect?
It is interesting. When the bill was rolled out on the House floor, there were several attempts to put amendments on it that would do just that, that would put it, set aside money to train state and local police on immigration law. And it's still, there's so many questions about how it would go into place. The question is, you can arrest those that you believe were crossing illegally. In other words, you watched them try and cross the Rio Grande. But yet, they're, you know, police in Fort Worth, I watched the police chief in Fort Worth saying that, we have no idea how this would plan out. We're not on the border, so how could we see credibly someone potentially crossing illegally? Opponents to the bill have always argued every step of the way that this is exactly the same as the Arizona law in 2010, the Show Us Your Papers law. So if you didn't see the person, but you have suspicion that they crossed illegally, what does that mean? And so, yeah, there has no training for local police, no training on immigration law. And those were two big issues that were brought up as the bill was being debated. Some have suggested that the law was written so vaguely with the intent of getting it to the U.S. Supreme Court, the argument being there that states can then fight to have some sort of right over their own immigration. In the case of Texas, lawyers for Texas argued in federal court, shouldn't the state have the right to defend its own borders when it's being invaded?
Yeah.
And the word invasion was big. And so, yeah, how it would actually play out in reality is some have suggested chaos.
We're hearing from CBS correspondent Chris Fox, who's in Austin, Texas, on the suspension of Texas's state immigration law. And I want to ask him about the enforcement of this law, how it would look. Police in Texas would be asked to detain anybody who they suspect is in the country illegally, which, of course, invites profiling people of Hispanic descent. But that's a problem in Texas because Texas is about 40% Hispanic.
None of that was spelled out in the law itself, which is part of the argument of why it's unconstitutional, to be completely honest, and what shot down the Arizona law. Governor Abbott, though, contends that the bill was designed to basically evade the courts, and that he still is holding out that this will be legal. It'll be interesting to see what the Fifth Circuit comes up with. It was interesting. The U.S. Supreme Court really couldn't jump in with a decision on Senate Bill 4 because they haven't had a hearing on it. And like I said, the only hearing happening in federal court in Austin. And the Fifth Circuit Court, which temporarily blocked a lower court decision, which would have allowed the law to take effect in early March, they hadn't had a hearing on it either. And so we're at least going to get a hearing out of it. It seems like before we find out anything. Judge Alito did this time, the previous two times he blocked the law, he did it with an expiration date. That's why we had the big countdown yesterday. This one, he finally extended the pause indefinitely. Other words, until a hearing in court.
So at this point, how do the people of the state of Texas feel about this? Is there still a lot of pressure at the border? Are they still feeling
Are they feeling like they're being invaded still?
Yeah, it's basically the state's ripped right in half and mostly falls along party lines. And the conservatives tend to believe that this is necessary. The state has the right. Those who live along the Rio Grande Valley are scared about this. You know, when you drive around there, it's interesting. I spent a lot of time in Uvalde, which is about 100 miles from the border, and some time in El Paso. It's amazing the presence of Border Patrol, far more than police. And so it is interesting to see how this would impact those who live in that area, especially since, if it allowed local police to pull over anybody by suspicion that they crossed illegally, which, hasn't really been defined either, suspicion of having crossed the border illegally. Governor Abbott, in one of his press conferences, when he signed it into law, suggesting, no, this is people who see them crossing the river illegally, but the law doesn't say that. So it'll be interesting to see. The rolling joke in Texas has always been the state legislature meets every odd year, and then every even year we spend all our time in court so, trying to find out if the bills that they just passed into law are legal. And that's exactly where we are now.
CBS correspondent Chris Fox in Austin, Texas. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Your daily dose of kindness is brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. A beloved security guard at Providence College was gifted the trip of a lifetime. James Mulgaji, and I hope I'm saying that right, has grown close with the students he helps protect. They got to know him, too, learning that he hadn't been able to visit his family in Nigeria in more than a decade. So the students hatched a plan and started a GoFundMe to get him there. And they surprised him with the news last month, but first shared what he meant to the students he cares for.
Dear Unc, you're the GOAT. You're one of those people that, like, really care about, and you've made the PC experience so good for all of us, for myself. Everyone here can testify to how good you are. And you told us a while ago that you wanted to see your family in Nigeria, which I haven't seen in a long time.
He's just kind of sitting there, and then the reveal.
Part of the family, so our gift to you is a trip to Nigeria, so.
He just covers his face. He's overcome with emotion as they hand him the envelope with enough money to get him to Nigeria. And then he kind of falls to the floor. I think he's just overwhelmed. He's okay. The GoFundMe did raise enough for him to go on that trip, which I said is about $3,000. And then some. I just did some deep diving and I checked the GoFundMe. And since the news of this generosity hit news feeds, that fund is now up to $30,000. That's some life-changing money. The students are going to give James all of the money that they raise at the end of the school year.
Nice thing to do. And here he is from the G and Ursula Show. G Scott.
Hey,
we're trying to figure out a way to get to make life more affordable for working people. And here's the latest idea.
Yeah.
From Bernie Sanders. Make the work week 32 hours, and then after that, overtime.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I absolutely love it, and I do think that this is the way for the future. But I'm sure that there will be a lot of companies, that will say, well, we can't do that, which that's fine, because sometimes I think that thinking can kind of be skewed a little bit. Let me start by asking a question of everyone that's listening right now. There's roughly, I think, 168 hours in a week. Besides sleeping, how many hours in a week do you dedicate to yourself? How many hours in a week do you dedicate just for you? I'm not talking about taking care of the kids. I'm not talking about anything. I'm talking about self-care, self-love for you, doing what
Lots
you want to do.
For me, but it took a break from work and reprogramming and therapy and medication. And, the productivity addiction that's in America is a disease.
Come on.
And so, I spend many hours on myself, but it took years to get
there. How many people right now, if I even say something like that, you feel guilty if you sit down and you take care of yourself? The reason it's important I'm bringing this up, because while there will be so many that will point to employers out here not wanting to adopt this model, right? This is my man Bernie Sanders wanting to do this. Meanwhile, we need to look inwards and realize that we're the problem too, because sometimes we feel so guilty about looking out for self first. And so this 32 hours a week, it's a no-brainer. We're talking about mental health as an issue now. I'm glad we're talking so much about it. I think people are overworked. I think they're underpaid. That's been a saying for years. They're overworked. They're underpaid. They don't have any time. So with those 2 days off, usually maybe you sleep in that next day, right? When you wake up. Okay, you get on up, you do a couple things. Maybe you're going to have to go have lunch with your friends or dinner with your friends or something like that. And before you know it, the next day is Sunday, and you're like, oh my goodness. Then you get the Sunday scaries, which you thought. You thought the Sunday scaries were going to be over when you were a child.
Right.
Little did you know that when you're an adult, it's still the same.
The whole weekend is spent catching up from the week.
60 minutes comes on, you know.
So my next question would be, how much better would every employee be if they had 3 days off a week as opposed to two?
I think it's a great idea.
I love it. I would love it. I'd have more time with my kids. I think about how little time I spend a lot of time on myself, and that's because I work an early morning shift, so I have time. My kids are at school or at daycare. They see me like 2 hours a day.
That's what I'm saying.
That's not enough.
Yeah.
It's not enough. And I think that's the case. It's even worse for families that work a 9-to-5, driving home in traffic. Their kids are tired. You know, they get no quality time with their kids. So who's influencing them?
Mm-hmm.
Not the family.
We talk about poverty, that's a big word that comes up, and usually it's attached to finances.
Mm-hmm.
But what we don't talk about, and which we should, can we talk about time poverty? Can we talk about all the parents out here that has 2 and 3 jobs and having to work and don't have as much time to spend with their kids or as much time to spend with their significant other?
Usually all the answer things. Is, well, then don't have kids. And it's like, you get that all the time where you're like, well, I can't afford childcare. Well, don't have kids.
Right.
Really?
Well, let me bring this up. There's a big article today about how AI is going to basically eliminate most jobs involving a computer.
Uh-huh.
And people have a lot of free time. And you're going to need some way of just handing them money so that they can live, even though there's really no jobs that need to be done except, you know, turn the machine on and walk away.
Yeah, that's why I tell everybody to go to trade school.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's why if you're coming out of high school and things like that, like the whole thing. Like for some reason, we went through a long stretch of time where jobs and employers use college degrees as the gatekeeper. Right? Because a lot of times people are working jobs that they didn't even major in, had nothing to do with their college major. So really, colleges was just a gatekeeper to keep certain parts of society out of it. So because we went so many years with that motto, that is so terrible right now. And so now, today, what do we have? How much does it cost to go to university for 4 years? Is it a lot of money these days?
20.
All right.
Sully, you know.
But
how much does it cost to send a kid to college these
days? Well, out of state is $35,000 a year just at a state school in Montana.
Oh, guess how much daycare is in state a year? $26,000.
And then here's the thing, though, Colleen. Everyone that's making the decisions about student loan debts and about those things, well, back in my day, Charlie, I paid all of my college because it was $10,000 for you to go for 4 years.
Oh, less than that.
We just solved America's financial problems. 32-hour work week. College is free.
I'll go on this. I don't know if you guys can hear it. This is something that I'm very passionate about.
Yeah.
And Colleen, I appreciate your vulnerability, sharing your story.
Always.
I'll share mine. October 2023 changed me. That's when I started going to therapy. That's when I started putting me first.
Okay.
And I'm telling you, anybody listening right now, sometimes our biggest problem is that we put everybody else first before ourselves. Come on now, baby.
Yes.
You put yourself first.
I'm happy for
you. Scott, 9 o'clock with Ursula. We're going to talk about product recalls. The Consumer Product Safety Commission announced 323 product recalls last year. That's the most in 7 years. They involved tens of millions of items, including toys, clothing, home appliances. And according to a new report, when a company offers a refund, and you always hear that, right, return it for a refund, it can sometimes be difficult to collect. So let's go to consumer man Herb Weisbaum, who's a contributing editor at checkbook.org, to talk about this. And these products were recalled because they're dangerous, so that's concerning. How dangerous are these products? What can happen to you if you decide, I'll risk it?
Yeah, these products are recalled, Dave, for a wide range of risks, including fire, burns, falls, cuts, choking, and suffocation, as well as exposure to toxic chemicals. And according to an analysis of those 323 product recalls last year by a consumer group called U.S. PIRG, they found that those recalls were connected to 550 injuries, 15 deaths, and more than 500 fires. So, A, it's concerning there are so many recalls, and it's really concerning if people don't find out about them or pay attention and return the products or stop using them.
Is there any typical reason why this happens? Is somebody not paying attention at the factory? Is it sabotage? Is it, bad equipment design? What is it?
No, what it is the fact that most people listening probably don't realize this, but for most of the 15,000 products that the CPSC regulates, there are no testing standards. Some products, such as bike helmets, can be banned before they hit the market if tests show they don't meet the government safety standards. But in most cases, there are no standards to meet, and the agency can only respond to complaints from consumers or reports from doctors or hospitals about products injuring people. So that's why it's really important, if you are injured by a product, to file a complaint with a Consumer Product Safety Commission. Something else that may come as a surprise to the listeners is that the recall process works as follows. You always hear it, you reported, Dave, voluntary recall announced by the Consumer Product Safety Commission.
Right.
That word voluntary is critical. The companies work with the government. The companies have to agree to the terms of the recall and the wording of the recall announcement. It's not up to the regulators. And if they want to fight this and stall or delay it, they can. So some of these recalls are delayed weeks or months, and the wording is sort of, because the companies get to control this. It's a very bizarre situation, but that's how product safety recalls work in this country, and that was how the system was designed by Congress. A lot of people have called for changing that to give the regulator more power to order these recalls. Happens in some rare cases, but it can take years for that process to play out. So that's another reason why there's so many dangerous products hitting the market. And then, of course, all the imports. We're buying things online from China and other companies that don't have a lot of the safety standards we do. Right. Put it all together, and you got a lot of dangerous products floating around.
Okay, now when they promise a refund, is it easy to get, or do you have to jump through hoops?
Well, this group, the U.S. PIRG, analyzed the companies that offered recalls and looked at the process, and they found out that in many cases, about half the time when a recall is offered, it's very difficult or challenging in order to get that recall. There's a lot of hoops to jump through. Maybe you have to call a telephone number that only works during normal business hours. Maybe the website is difficult to use. Maybe the website makes you order a form that they send you, then you have to fill the form out. Sometimes you have to take it back to the store. So this group, the point of their report was suggesting that they have to make this process easier. And then get this, you think a refund means you're getting your money back, right? You're going to get a check or maybe a debit card. Well, for some companies, a refund means we're going to give you a credit towards another purchase from our company, or a prorated refund based on the age of the product. So you bought the product that was dangerous, but they didn't let you know about it for a couple of years. So we're going to, well, you got a couple of years out of that blender that could break apart and throw shrapnel all over the place. We're going to prorate the refund. So there's a call for, they just wanted to point out how bizarre our process is, and maybe there's a need to do some changing. I think they had a good point.
But do other countries do it differently?
I don't know how they do in other countries, but I know when it comes to customer safety, that consumer safety, that Europe is way ahead of us, and they have much stronger rules, and I would dare say it's probably done a lot better overseas than it is here. That's basically all I can say about that one.
But it does strike me as being kind of scattershot. You have to be tuned into the radio and happen to hear the story to even know your product is being recalled sometimes. So is there any central location that you can check from time to time? Or, you know, can you get a push alert when there's a major recall?
Yeah, the federal government has a website where they can give you, and you can search for that. And also, you can basically... the other reason I meant to point out is that if you fill out those the forms that you get to say register your product, for the warranty,
right,
you don't have to do that. You don't have to fill it out to get the warranty. Your protection is guaranteed whether you fill out the card or not. But if you register your product, you will be able to be alerted. They'll contact you if indeed there is a recall. So that's one of the big reasons for why you want to do that. I have a lot more information on my story on checkbook.org that lists how you can file complaints. complaints and where you can get these recall notices. Also, the problem has come to the attention of the CPSC about this, that they now have a recall complaint form. And they're saying if you get the runaround trying to get a recall product, the company to take it back or give you a refund, fill out this complaint form. We want to know about it. It's kind of interesting that they've actually set up a complete complaint form for that.
Well, yeah. I think it's essential. If some of these things are as dangerous as you say, then it's worth keeping up with. I know that last time I bought a car, and you signed for the recall notices, they're very good about that for some reason. The car dealers seem to be more than happy to get you to come into the shop to get the car fixed, because chances are you might buy something else, I guess. But I appreciate that, frankly.
No, and by the way, the website you can look for, saferproducts.gov, is where you can look for these recalls and sign up for alerts, S-A-F-E-R, saferproducts.gov. The reason why it's so important to get these products off the market, Dave, is if people don't find out about it and they don't know about it, A, they can pass it along to a family member, they can give it to a charity, Goodwill or something, and somebody else could get hurt. They could sell it online in these marketplaces. The key is, if it's recalled, it's dangerous, we got to get it off the market. We really have to do a better job of dealing with these dangerous products and maybe stopping them from getting in the market in the first place.
Consumer man Herb Weisbaum, contributing editor at checkbook.org. Thank you, Herb.
Thank you, David.
And that's Mickey time. Oprah Winfrey had a big special last night. Mm-hmm. It was about, no surprise, weight loss. And you watched it. What did you think?
You know, I went into it with kind of a chip on my shoulder, you know, because number one, she's Oprah Winfrey. She has a lot of power and influence, and there's already a shortage of the medication that I take. And so I'm like, great, I'm going to watch this special. And then there's going to be an even bigger shortage now because I can't get my medication until mid-April, according to my pharmacy, because it's on back order.
Just because it's not enough.
There's just not enough. There's so many people taking it. But after watching it, and I watched it this morning, I cried.
Yeah.
I just thought, okay, wow. Here's Oprah.
This is like what she does best.
Right. And what I found was just her journey is very similar to mine. Can I play a little promo for you really quickly here?
Obesity is a complex disease.
They are the new drugs sparking the weight loss revolution.
All of a sudden, I felt like I was freed.
But there's confusion and controversy. Are the medications safe? Should children take them?
She would be 500 pounds.
Oh, honey.
Yeah.
You're getting emotional about it. I can understand why. It's probably cathartic to hear your story come from somebody so powerful as Oprah, but then all of the people she interviewed.
Yeah.
The one that got me the most, and I don't know if you can relate to this, is when the gal said, my whole life, and, you know, she was overweight. They showed pictures of her. She said, I just thought, this is who I was, these voices in my head. Mm-hmm. Where am I going to get my next meal? How am I going to eat? What am I going to eat? All she ever thought about was food. What is that called?
It's a phrase. Food noise.
Food noise. And she said this medication
quiets.
It's like that the voices went away. And I understood it from the perspective of intrusive thoughts, suicidal ideation, and how medication has helped me with that. And then to hear this also happens with food noise.
Yeah.
It broke my heart. And I'm just happy that this miracle drug is there.
It is. And what gets me is the shaming that people do when they find out that I am on a medication like this. And
it's the easy way out.
Like, it's the easy. Yeah. And there's nothing easy about having to take a once weekly injection and then deal with all the side effects that go along with it. However, it's the one thing that saved my life. When I had decided that I was going to start taking this medication, I was at the point of weight loss surgery. My doctor said, we've got to do something. And I know we've tried dieting, we've tried exercise, nothing is working. Your body is holding on to this fat and it won't let it go. So before we go down the surgery route, let's try this medication because I want your A1C to go down. Your A1C is too dangerously high.
What's A1C?
So it's a 3-month blood test that collects where your blood sugar levels are at. And mine were at the point of organ failure.
Wow.
As a type 2 diabetic. And nothing was working. And the food noise was running rampant. All I kept thinking about was, when's my next meal going to be? And what am I going to eat? And food. And so when I started this medication, the food noise stopped.
What was that like?
It was freeing. I think I became a better human being. I believe that I became more creative at work. I took off. My career here really took off, being able to open my mind and let it be filled with creativity. And I truly believe that I walked into the woman that I was supposed to be because my mind wasn't focused on food anymore. Where's my next meal going to be? I wasn't starving. I wasn't living impoverished. I could afford food. But all I kept thinking about it was it. And that one little shot took all of that food noise away. And it was so interesting when I told people I'm on this medication. Well, why can't you just diet?
Yeah. Diet and exercise.
Diet and that didn't work for me. People don't realize this.
Not a one size fits all.
I used to be a triathlete. I was the heaviest triathlete on my triathlon person on my team at 245 pounds. So when I saw the special last night, it was just the shame, the blame, and weight loss revolution, which is what Oprah titled it. I was blown away.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that Oprah and I had something in common. And all of these other people, men and women, had something in common. In my entire adult life, I've never been this small, and I still have 25 more pounds to go, 20 to 25.
So what's the wait time now for before you can get your drug again?
Well, they say mid-April, and I have some smaller doses in my refrigerator because I had a feeling that something like this would eventually happen. So I'm going to just take the smaller doses until I can get
my... So you're able to... keep to your new habits without backsliding, huh?
Well, I hope. I mean, I'm really hoping that I can. They say that we will be on these GLP-1 medications for the rest of our lives. I will because I am a type 2 diabetic. So, yes, I will have to stay on this because when I get off of it, my type 2 diabetes will come back. I mean, it's just kind of dormant. The medication keeps it dormant.
Wow. Mickey Gomez, good luck.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you will never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.